Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, and of course, wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Spotify. And we have another fabulous guest. Authors, we love them, on the podcast. And it's so funny because sometimes I feel like I know people from Twitter, even though I consciously know I don't know them, but you just feel like you do. And Samira Ahmed is one of those people. Samira is the New York Times bestselling author, and her upcoming book, Hollow Fires, pubs on May 10th, 2022. So by the time you're listening to this episode, the book will be out. So I hope you have pre-ordered it. And if anything, order it again. If you have. So thanks so much for being on.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me. I'm so glad that you know me through my random and wild Twitter feed.
Yeah, especially when your first book came out, Love, Hate, and Other Filters. And then I was like, oh, yay. I just remember there are just so many more South Asian authors writing for young people, especially young adults. And that was just like, there's just more visibility, more attention, more opportunity to be able to engage. So it was just like, oh, and I'm just so glad like you just had the success you've had.
Aw, thank you. That's so kind of you. Thanks.
So you've written a few books. You've contributed to a bunch of anthologies. You've been busy, as I said before I press record.
I've been so busy. You got to hustle in this business.
Yeah, I was talking to Erin and Trotta Kelly earlier this year, and I was like, Erin, you publishing a book a year? So is that what's happening? And she's like, yes, I just go into the next one. I just keep going into the next one.
I'm on a book a year right now, too. I mean, this year it's actually going to be two books because May is Hollow Fires. And then this fall, I have my second book in my middle grade fantasy series or the duology coming out. So this year it's two. Which I really need a nap at some point.
Right. And there's an intensity because also a couple previous guests have multiple books coming out this year, if not last year. So Renee Watson had four last year. All different readers.
All different. Renee is truly a Wonder Woman in every sense of the word. I mean, because she's not just doing only her book. She's just doing so many things. She's an incredible person. I'm not up to that level, but I can admire it.
You're an incredible person too. You are super incredible, very giving, always very transparent.
Thank you. Transparent? I'm so glad that you said that because I think transparency is important in our industry. I think it's like ethically important. But I also don't want people to confuse transparency with necessarily me telling everything about myself. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Like I like some distance or I like to maintain some distance between kind of just there's things that I like to keep private, you know, in my personal life. But I also think when you're putting yourself out there as an author on social media, you do have to have some level of transparency in the work that you're doing. Because social media has this weird way of distorting things, right? Because it's edited. I mean, we're self-editing, we're self-censoring, all of those things. And I do too. I mean, like, if I'm taking pictures for Instagram, I'm definitely wearing makeup. Because you might not want to see the bags under my eyes when I wake up, or I don't want to see them. So there's that kind of level. But, you know, we pick and choose what we put on there. And I just try to be straight with it. Like, yeah, I mean, this is how I'm looking right now. This is what I'm talking about right now. But that's not me every minute of every day.
Right. And it can be a help and a hindrance, especially in our industry, when words are so crucial. Of what are we saying? What are we presenting? And again, writing, maybe not primarily depending on the person, but when you do write a book for young readers, to me, that is so crucial of not just who you're presenting yourself to be, like you said, even though we're edited and whatnot, but also how we're engaging in the work and who we are when people meet us or think they know us.
Right. I mean, I think I jokingly say that if you are following me on Twitter or on Instagram, the things that you're going to see most are politics, prose, and pastries. And it's sort of true. Like, I kind of live up to those things. I mean, I am by nature a political person, but I also think being a woman of color in the United States, we are compelled to be political because our lives are politicized, right? So I think it's really important for me to speak on it, however it comes up. Like if people saw me tweeting recently, yesterday for the two of us, I was tweeting about this Nazi romance that was being published. Another one.
Size, another one.
that sold at auction, which I was thinking, my goodness, like in this day and age, we're still doing this publishing. What is wrong with you? Like, what is going on? So I do think it's important for me to just put it out there because that's just who I am. And I think that any publisher who takes me on understands that. I have heard stories, and I'm sure you've heard them too, of authors who publishers have, you know, there's sometimes these clauses that are getting put into publishing contracts.
And
sometimes
the authors have been,
yes, conduct clauses. And sometimes authors are getting chastised for, I mean, maybe subtly chastised for things that they're tweeting about. I don't think that's right. I think we should be able to speak to it. I mean, it's one thing if you're tweeting out like racist shit. In that case, yes, you don't need to be published. No publisher needs to publish you. But I do think that when you're taking a stand against oppression, bigotry, you know, homophobia, I don't think those are controversial positions, even though some people in our industry think they are. But I write a lot about characters finding their voice and giving voice to injustices because we need to speak those things out loud. And I feel like I have to live that too.
Yeah. And it's so crucial, I think, the more, like when I talk to folks like you, and especially, again, not to say like one's age defines their importance in relation to anything per se, but like you were saying earlier, there is an importance to have our elders' voice and, you know, remember ancestors and things like that. And I feel like when I talk to people, especially those who have worked with children, who have done political work, I remember reading in your bio, you have had some experience with political campaigns, there's kind of a different level of framing that you're coming to when you come to the page. And you said, you know, you have the three P's, prose, politics, and pastries, all of which are my jam, by the way.
Right. Well, I do not yet consider myself an elder, I guess, but thank you for giving me that. I mean, I am a Gen Xer.
To like the teens.
Yes, of course. That's totally true. Like, yes, totally true. I mean, of course, teens, I think of elders as like, you know, the auntie generation, but of course I'm an auntie too. I am literally an auntie. So, and I do think that I'm a Gen Xer. So just to be transparent, I feel like one of the things that I can bring is some of the wisdom of that experience. And because I did a lot of things before I became a writer, like you mentioned, I was a high school English teacher and I worked in education nonprofits. I worked at a nonprofit that sued the state of New York for inadequately funding public schools. And my job was to go around talking about how wrong Governor Pataki was in his approach to school funding, which, as you could probably imagine, was a really fun job.
I grew up mostly with Pataki, not a fan.
So I really had the pleasure of going around to like 700 school districts across the state of New York. Talking about how we were suing Governor Pataki because of his failure to provide an opportunity for sound basic education to all of New York's children, specifically in our big cities and also our property poor suburban and rural districts, which there are many in New York. So that was one of my jobs. I also was, I worked for a little while on the Obama campaign. I was in Easton, Pennsylvania, doing a wide variety of things to make sure we could turn Pennsylvania blue. Those experiences are a way, the lens through which I can write, if that makes sense. My past experiences influence my writing. I think it's, you know, natural that, you know, writers bring our past to the page. But I feel lucky that I've gotten to age. You know, I know people who have passed away at a too young age, and I think aging is a gift. And part of being a recipient of that gift means being able to share what wisdom we've had or some of our experiences. And I do try to bring a lot of that to my books. And I think that's where a lot of my hope comes from. I know sometimes people ask me about how I write about kind of tough topics or sometimes bleak topics, and Hollow Fires definitely has a sadness to it, a bleakness to it. But I also hope that they can see that I'm writing from a place of hope, and that actually stems from my past experiences. And I don't know, that's really important to me.
And I feel like that makes sense. Why wouldn't who we are inform what we produce? Like, isn't that part of the point? And also the bigger discussion of why erasure and all this stuff is so damaging.
Because 100%.
Right. Like the circles, I know you have also gone in terms of this conversation of censorship versus canceling versus da, 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 da. And it's like, it's all BS. Because it's all about one thing. It's literally all about one thing. I don't necessarily want to, it's because I don't want to have to deal with the kind of stuff a Samir Ahmed book is trying to tell me. I'm just right. not mentally or psychologically, or I just don't want to, from a narcissistic place, from a place of privilege, you know what I mean?
That's a lot. I think it's really interesting to see the reactions I get to my books from adults versus teens, especially right now. We're talking in this time of book banning and what I call, you know, quote unquote, quiet banning, which is still banning, and what it means for there to be discomfort. You know, when I talk to, say, a group of teachers, or which I love doing because I was a former teacher, I will literally say to them, part of my job in this 40 minutes I have with you is to make you uncomfortable and to ask you to sit just for this little time that I have with you in this discomfort so we can think about all of the kids in our schools who live with a discomfort so much worse than this every single day of their lives. And I try to, some of that is in my book. So yeah, my books are definitely going to make some people uncomfortable. But to speak to your point about bring ourselves to the page, I mean, I think as writers, you know, we have to be keen observers of both the internal and the external, right? And both of those things combined are what we bring to our stories. And I just think that's so important. Plus, you know, all the things that we take in, input is also output. So I don't know. I think that act of creation of a book, when you're looking at that act through these various lenses, is just so fascinating.
And I feel like that's a bigger conversation that we all have, because I was talking to someone I'm mentoring at my full-time job, and she's a person of color, newer to the industry, and we were talking about judging contests and the experiences we've had, especially when they're the quote-unquote diverse contests. And so they encourage people who are diverse to write diverse stories, and the way someone, I guess, interprets that is how they interpret it. And we were talking about craft, because I think certain aspects of conversation, and this is actually related, of course, to your work as well, is for you as author, you're writing, especially for the YA audience, some kind of hard-hitting stories, you know, especially with Hollow Fires. And there's an understanding, I think, universally that, you know, you want to be honest, but you don't want to sugarcoat. But also, what is it like to put certain things on the page? What stereotypes are we unconsciously putting into work? All these things, whether we are or not of the group. And I was talking to the other person and just saying, you know, this is a craft discussion. And I feel like we don't, royal we, what have you, don't frame it as that. And I wish it was framed as that, because I feel like you talk about craft a lot.
I love talking about craft. I don't like the diversity panel at the con or the festival. I was like, don't put me on the diversity panel. That, why are we still having anything like that right now in 2022? Because, you know, those diversity panels end up just being like, okay, hey, we asked five authors of color to come and speak about why diversity is important. I mean, do we really need to have this conversation anymore? I won't be on panels like that. And I mean, I remember one time I was on this panel and I was on the panel with two other authors of color. And the title of the panel, which was not one that we gave, was the quote, American experience.
No, they literally, did not. They did not.
The word American was put in quotes. And of course, I completely addressed that during the panel, because I said something to the presenter about that. And she said, well, I didn't think of this title, but I'm going to ask you the question. And so the final question was, and so what do we think about the title of this panel? And I was like, well, let me tell you why it's so ridiculous to put that in quotes, because what that basically means is the American experience is white and you three up here aren't white. So talk about your American experience. And that's just the same as those questions that I get, you know, that so many people of color get, which is the, where are you from? And then when you answer, well, I'm from Chicago, the follow-up question is, no, where are you really from? Or where are you from? As if, because that question is being asked against this normative backdrop, and that normative is whiteness. When people are asking you that question, they're not satisfied when your answer is, I grew up in Illinois. I'm from New York. My family's from Boston. They don't want that answer. And I just find that maddening. But In any case, getting back to your craft question, that's why I love talking about craft. When we are writing our novels, authors of color are not thinking, how am I going to diversify my stories in the same way that, say, a white author is going to think about it? We don't need to address it in that way because it's just, it's who we are. It's the skin we live in. And that's going to be reflected in our stories. That doesn't mean we're not going to have sensitivity readers or what I like to do, which is what I call like sensitivity interviews, where I talk to people from the backgrounds which I might be writing about before I write or in the midst of writing the novel. But I just think I am begging festival organizers and conference organizers to put authors of color on craft panels, not just panels that are trying to speak only to diversity.
Praises, let's hope. They've changed them to of color sometimes. It'd be like, you know, I was recently, last month, yes, I was on a panel called Publishing in Color. It was a great discussion. We had a really great discussion, but it was also one of those of like, let us talk about the industry from the perspective of being people of color. And what the moderator, I appreciated because it wasn't really a craft talk, said, you know, like, how do we hold people accountable? Looking for actionable ways to do things, to be there for each other, to hold other people accountable to do. And I was like, okay, this is just like, all right.
I mean, I actually think that kind of panel is interesting. It's different than what I'm talking about when authors are like at a con and then it's like, here's the four authors of color. Look, we have a South Asian. Look, we have a Black author. Look, we have a Latinx author. And we're putting them all together, even though their books are not related. And we're going to talk about, where do you write your diverse stories from? I mean, we need to move beyond that, I think.
Way, way beyond. Way, way beyond.
Way beyond. I mean, I remember one of the very first, I went to this librarian conference, a regional conference, when Love and Other Filters came out. And it was a state conference. And a librarian there asked me, she was from kind of a small rural area. And she said, there are no Muslims in our town. And in the schools here, our town is mostly all white. So how do I convince my director that we should buy your book and put it on our shelves? Where would your book belong? And I was like, it belongs on a shelf with all the other books. My literal response to her was, you do not need to be from the same race / ethnicity / intersection as the author or main character to read the book, because I read Lord of the Rings and I'm not a hobbit. It was almost like this weird revelation to her when I said that. When we say way beyond, it's so frustrating because, I mean, that was 2018. That's not that long ago. And I still get variations on questions like that. There's no Muslims at our school. Yeah, there's no Muslims at our school. Should we read your book? I mean, the fact that there's no Muslims at your school probably means you definitely should read my book. Let the kids meet a Muslim, if not in real life, at least on the page. You know, one that's not just being depicted as a terrorist like they see on TV.
Because Hollow Fires is a mystery. When we look at the categories, it's like, oh, it's a mystery and it's this and all these things. But at the heart of it, it's an investigation for the sake of two people who just need to know the truth. Kind of like what you tapped into earlier as well, in terms of like the characters you've been writing about. Like, I say this, is it fair to ask if you could summarize your book?
Sure. I'm actually terrible at the elevator pitch, but Hollow Fires is a thriller about a young woman who is trying to uncover the mystery of what happened to a boy who went missing. My main character, Sophia, has a point of view, and the boy who goes missing, Jawed, also has a point of view. And Sophia is an Indian American Muslim. Jawed is the child of Iraqi refugees whose father was translator for American troops, and they came to the United States. And he goes missing. The media does not seem too interested in it. People seem to quickly forget this young man. And so as Sophia is trying to uncover the truth of what's happened to him, and as she's just really trying to tell people like, hey, this is a kid. We have to figure out what happened to him. Like, his life is worthy of being known and remembered, and he deserves to have some justice, even though, you know, we all know justice is not always easy to find. And even when we find our answers, they're not always just, right? And I have also incorporated found documents in the novel because I wanted to directly speak to what happens when crimes are committed against people of color and how they are depicted in the media. So for example, Jawed, who, like I said, is Iraqi American, when he's described in the, you know, mainstream media, he's talked about as just an Iraqi refugee. And of course they mispronounce it. Iraqi, I can't even say the mispronunciation right, but it's one of those things that really bugs me. And there are people in quote unquote journalists who want to investigate his past. This 14-year-old boy must have had something that he's done wrong. There was an incident at school where he was accused of being a terrorist. Did he really have terrorist ties? I mean, it's the same way that we've seen time and time again, where especially Black and Brown young men who are victims of crime are made to seem as if they are the criminal. I mean, we see it all the time in cases of police brutality. I specifically reference in Hall of Fires the rapist from Stanford, who people know as the Stanford swimmer, because that's how the press was talking about this white man who had raped this young woman, and how we always give white perpetrators the benefit of the doubt, how they're always the quiet boy next door who wouldn't do anything. I can't believe that he would do this. This doesn't seem like it's in his character, versus when we have the Black or Brown victim of a crime and we have to find out that, oh, well, this person was shot by the police, but you know what? 12 years ago, they smoked a joint. Maybe there's a reason the police shot them. I mean, I just wanted to speak to that because it's just so pervasive. And I think we don't examine it enough. And this novel is really looking at those notions of truth and fact and lies and alternative facts and how that alters our view of reality.
And we hear from both of these characters. I mean, it's not spoiling anything because you mentioned it. And also, it's pretty much in the prologue. And then we get into it about...
I mean, there's no spoilers in this. He is dead.
Yeah. But he still speaks, not just like the journalism and all that, the evidence, so to speak, you know, to kind of further shed light on what you were saying in terms of the bias and the hate that he experienced, but also we hear from him and it's very sad.
I know. It was so sad. It was so hard to write his voice. Jawed, the character in my book, is fiction, but in so many ways, he feels real because I read so many accounts of young people who have gone missing and no one's looking for them. I mean, we've seen this time and again. I mean, Tiffany Jackson actually has written about this.
Money's not coming.
Money's not coming and no one's paying attention. We've seen this in both Canada and the United States with Indigenous women going missing and nobody seeming to be bothered. I just wanted to speak to that because it is incredibly pervasive. It was so hard to write because it was just sad. You know, I read all these accounts of examples where this had happened, and this was a young man in the story who was loved, who had hopes and dreams and passions, who loved being an inventor, a tinkerer, and his life is cut short and no one seems to care.
And you wrote, I have the arc. There was, usually for those who are listening and may not know, authors can write a letter that can appear in the front of the arc, be it digital or print. And you wrote, I wrote this book because we've lost too many people to hate and because so often we've witnessed the powerful and the privileged get away with murder. I wrote this book to tell a truth. And that feels just like, that's you. Like every, especially with the young adult books, you wrote this book to tell a truth. And these are hard truths, like internment, and these aren't easy subject matter to write. And they're still people. And that's also ties into what I say when it's like, this is about craft.
I mean, thank you for this question, actually. I think I believe that fiction tells a truth. And sometimes, I don't know if easier is the right word, but sometimes we need to read it in sort of the safe space of the pages of a novel before we can confront it in the real world. And I hope that reading some of those things in my books will help readers wake up to the realities in which many people are living, in which many young people live. It's not easy to write these stories always because, you know, you always feel like you're leaving a little piece of yourself in the book. But these are the stories that move me. You know, these are the stories that I feel like I have to tell because storytellers need to be truth tellers. And that's just really important to me. And also in crafting the quote unquote bad guys, I think it's still important to write them as three dimensional, right? In Hollow Fires and in Tournament and in Love, Hate, and Other Filters, while I'm not trying to necessarily garner sympathy for those characters who commit terrible acts, those characters are also people who might have been raised by parents who loved them, who also maybe had some kind of hopes and dreams, who were friends with people. And I think it's interesting to ask the question, what turns a person? What makes a person potentially morally bankrupt? What happens in a person's life, or what do they read? How are they recruited, for example, into white supremacy? How are they radicalized online into white supremacy? That's something that Hall of Fires deals with, because that's something that's very much reality-based. And I did a ton of research about how young white men are radicalized online. And you can read the articles about this. Those young men, you know, maybe they're going to church. You know, their moms are also probably saying, oh, but this is my little boy. He's never done a single bad thing. I'm so shocked that he would do this. So I try to give a wholeness to all of my characters, even when they're doing terrible things. I always feel like the scariest monsters are the ones you know.
I think that's also very pervasive, given everything that's gone on, right? Is especially 2020, you know, June 2020 sticks out a lot in people's mind, especially my mind. And then seeing people who actively are like, I really feel horrible and I want, and then turn around and do something so insensitive. And you're just like, how does that happen? How is this possible? But it ties to what you said, because it's like it's ingrained to an extent.
You know, I'm really interested in when we look at the assault on the Capitol at January 6th, and you look at who was there. I mean, yeah, some of these people were probably playing militia or whatever. Other of them were suburban folks taking the bus up, whose anger and outrage was fomented by politicians and lies on the news by some news stations. Look, I mean, I tweeted this, I'm just going to say this. Like, I feel so much the Republican sort of MO for the last 40 years, at least since Reagan, has been to defund schools as much as possible, to attack public schools and social safety nets, and to keep people as ignorant as possible, because ignorance and hate go so much hand in hand. And ignorant people are easier to rule and easier to influence. And I think that was pretty clear when we see like what was happening in the early days of the pandemic with anti-maskers, anti-vaxxers, and who was continuing to spread those lies, you know, with impunity. So I don't know. I do think it's important for all of us. I do think it's important for us to address it. I think that young people are constantly being confronted by that. I think it's our young people are much smarter than we usually give them credit for. They're really observant. They're aware of the world around them. And I feel an ethical obligation to be truthful to them and respect their intelligence when I'm writing.
And how do you feel like those conversations have gone so far, especially since, I mean, there is a variety to the books that you have written, you know, Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, and Internment, and Love, Hate, and Other Filters. And I think essentially, like, for some people, maybe they know you most by Internment, and or maybe Love, Hate, and Other Filters, since that was your debut and it did very well. And then you also, like you said, you have The Middle Grade with Amira and Amza. When you kind of talk to young people about a book like Internment, or prepare yourself to talk to young people about a book like Hollow Fires, is there kind of like a point that you just really want to enforce at the end of the day of like, if these kids come out of this conversation with nothing else, I want them to understand their voices matter, that these mm-hmm. things happen, that people are multidimensional but can still cause harm? Or are there kind of like just specific areas that you just really want to kind of key in, considering this is hard?
Yeah, well, all those things you said. But I think one thing that's interesting is a question that I've gotten a lot over the last couple of years from students is, what can I do? How could I be like your character, Layla or Maya? Like, how do I speak up? And I think that's a great question. I sort of put that back out onto the kids, because I like to say that the through line of those stories that you mentioned, I mean, they are different and I write in different genres, but I have this through line of what I like to call the revolutionary girl. And in my mind, revolutions are not necessarily just loud taking up arms against our oppressor. I mean, sometimes they are, like an internment where they're, Layla's literally trying to lead people out of an internment camp and take on, you know, the evil forces within the government. But sometimes it can be a quieter thing, which is just speaking up for yourself, finding your own voice and the truth of who you are. Sometimes it can be like in Hollow Fires, where Sophia is trying to uncover the truths of what happened to a young boy, a boy whose life was important and mattered. I mean, all of those things, even listening can be a radical act. there can be, there's a notion of radical acceptance. So I talk to young people a lot about those things, because sometimes your revolutionary act is just going to be a small step. Sometimes you speaking up for a friend who's being bullied. Sometimes you speaking up when you're in the locker room and you hear that quote unquote locker room talk and you're like, hey, man, that's not cool. Sometimes it's just being there for a friend who needs you. I mean, it's not always easy to stand up to a bully or to do those things. But I really just encourage young people to try to find their voice and maybe just take a really small first step, because their voices are so, so important. And all around us, we're surrounded by young people who are so truly inspiring. I mean, sometimes it's on this very giant level, like Malala or Greta. But sometimes it's like this kid in my neighborhood who, at the start of the pandemic, he was in seventh grade, I believe. And maybe he was younger. I think he was in seventh grade, middle school. At the start of the pandemic, you know how there was this mask shortage, right? So what he did was learn how to figure out how to sew cloth masks, and he distributed them at local nursing homes and then got friends to learn how to sew those masks, to help make more of those masks so they could distribute them to nursing homes when we were having that mask shortage. To me, that's incredible. You know, he wasn't in the New York Times or anything else, but he did this incredibly heroic deed, I think. And so sometimes these revolutionary acts and ideas can start with just the smallest thing of thinking of how you can just help a person who might need it, how you can just do something good in your community, how you can speak up, whether it's in an op-ed for your school newspaper or a letter to the editor of your community paper, or just when you hear something that you know is wrong, that you know could be hurtful to someone. Just speaking up is an incredibly powerful thing. And I really know it's not easy, but part of why I write these stories is because I hope young people can see some of these characters who are just like them. You know, my characters are girls like all the other girls, even Miss Marvel. I mean, I'm writing a superhero, but ultimately Miss Marvel is someone who's trying to show young people, look, anyone can be a hero, even if you don't have beginning powers.
And she's such an indelible figure these days. Ms. Marvel.
I love writing Ms. Marvel. I mean, I'm very excited for all the things that are going to come for her beyond just the comics. But I think that's what's really cool about that character, and she is a South Asian Muslim superhero, which had never been done. And she's also, like I said, a girl like all the other girls. You know, she has friends. I'm trying to fight both zits and bad guys on the same day. She's just a girl who's trying her best to do good, to do the right thing. And I think that's why she resonates with so many people. She feels real.
I feel like that's the hardest part when we're creating. How to make people feel real.
I mean, I think that goes back to your craft question, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we can, when I'm writing these sort of heroic characters in my books, and even writing Ms. Marvel, they're all people who have flaws, who don't always make good decisions, because believe it or not, as a teenager, you might not always make the best choices for yourself or for others. I mean, sometimes you do things that are ridiculous and unsafe. Like,
it doesn't end.
I know, exactly. It doesn't end. It just changes the way you do it. I mean, like, yep. When I was a teenager, I was growing up in the Midwest. In the winter, my friends and I would go and do like donuts with our cars. Go on a kind of like, and this was like on the street, go on an icy street doing donuts with a car. So incredibly dangerous. Please, no one do this because it's not safe. And yet here we are. I mean, I was like one of the people who other parents would probably look at as like one of the good kids. I wasn't a kid who was getting in trouble, and yet I was still doing dumbass things. I think that making a character real and believable means they have to be a fully formed character. And I try to do that for even my characters who are, you know, not the protagonist, but the supporting characters. Sometimes they're funny. Sometimes they're in bad moods. Sometimes they don't show up for their friend when they say they will. Sometimes they don't turn their homework in when they're supposed to, which is, as a former teacher, it's painful for me to write. And yet, that's reality. So I just think when you write your characters, if you want them to feel real to young people, you have to make them three-dimensional. And you also cannot talk down. A lot of times people who don't read young adult fiction will ask me questions about that. You know, like I will tell them the topic that I'm writing about. And they're like, well, you're writing about that for teenagers, for young adults? That seems like really hard. And I'm like, well, yeah, but have you met any young people lately? Have you met any teens or talked to them? They're confronting a lot of hard truths right now in our lives. I mean, especially in these last few years with the pandemic and what happened, all the things that happened under the Trump administration. And it's unfortunate that part of their their childhood has they've had to deal with this. But one of the things my books also explore are these moments in childhood when life is shattered and how no matter how you prepare for it, you're never really prepared for it, right? Because young people are so often subject to horrible consequences because of really terrible choices that the adults around them have made. Like our old men decide to go to wars and the ones that they send to fight them are our young people.
That feels also like a hard note to try to end this on. So I'm trying to like...
Sorry, I know, right? Yes, it is. Sorry. I mean,
I
know
it's like
it makes me sound like I'm a total hard ass, which I am in some ways. If you ask any of my former students, but
this is serious stuff, and we care, so it makes sense to be again as transparent as possible. As we established, and let's not force it to be like, oh, let's end on like a happy note. Cause it's like, it's
well, I mean, really, I guess
I feel like this is a good note too.
I think it's a hopeful note because I wouldn't write these books if I didn't believe in not necessarily the happy ending, but if I didn't have hope for the future. And when I say that we should respect young people, I really mean it because I've met and taught so many young people and I'm so privileged to have done that. And truly, so many of them have just blown me away with their kindness, their intelligence, their willingness to be open to new ideas. I just love that about them. And that's partially why I love writing for young adults.
Kids are deep.
I know. I remember this young man and he was 17 years old. I was talking to him and he said this really interesting thing to me, which was about how as he saw the world, this was a long while ago when I was still a teacher, this was in New York, as the news and all of these things in the world were swirling around him, he was taking it in and he said, you know, I'm at the age where I'm just forming my politics. And so I try to read as much as I can. And I thought, my God, that is just such an incredibly observant and keen insight. I'm at this age where I'm just forming my politics. And as a teacher for young adults and as a writer for young adults, I think it's such an incredible privilege to be able to participate in that process by writing stories for teens and young adults. Like, what a cool and amazing thing to be able to be a part of.
And also props to that kid, because I know I wasn't saying that.
I mean, I was like, this kid and so many like him are just savvy as hell. Like, they're just, I mean, young people, especially today, have a, not just teens, but like kids younger than teens, because now I'm starting to visit middle schools a lot. They have a savviness about them. They have, some of them have a world weariness about them already, which I'm like, oh no. But they're very observant and they are aware of things that are happening around them. And that's, you know, like with these book bans, a lot of the people are fighting against it are young people because they're like, look, you are saying that you want to ban these books because it makes us uncomfortable when the real people who are being made uncomfortable are you, the adults, because you're stuck, you're mired in some kind of racist, homophobic mindset.
And what do you have to face once you break that down?
I mean, that's why I think those adults who are like that are scared to face it.
Mm-hmm.
They're scared to face the reality of who they are.
Terrifying. Must be terrifying. And this is why I'm in therapy, y'all. It makes it a lot easier when you're just like, all right, well,
you're like,
the
let
world
me unload
will not
on
crash
this person.
If I admit I did something wrong.
You know what? Admitting you do things wrong is just so important. If I mess up on Twitter, I do try to say that I effed up. Like, I say sorry to people too. I mean, you know, I'm a mom and sometimes I mess up and I will apologize to my kids. And I know not all parents think you should do that, but I'm like, why? You mess up. You're a human. Like, right. Sometimes, believe it or not, that's part of the human condition. But another part of the human condition is realizing when you've made a mistake, realizing when you've hurt someone, realizing when you've messed up, and saying, I am sorry for this action that I did. Like an actual apology, not saying, I'm sorry that you felt bad, but saying, I'm sorry I caused this injury, or I'm
Thank
sorry
you for
that my action.
The difference. Thank
I am
you.
Sorry that I caused this harm, and I will do better. And here's how I'm going to try to learn to do better. I mean, it's really honestly not that hard. I strongly encourage adults to do that more.
And it's refreshing. It's freeing. It's really freeing because then you don't have to protect whatever it is you're protecting. That's what I found.
And also, you know what? It's also actually like a kindness to yourself. It's extending yourself some grace, because it's just saying, I'm just a person and I'm learning, and I didn't have knowledge of X, Y, or Z, and maybe I should have. Now I know what I got to do next.
Right. I go to sleep very easily. I mean, let me rewind that a little bit. I don't want to seem glib, because it's not easy time, but at least in terms of what I've put out in the world, and when I try to rectify, like you said, when you apologize, when you realize, when you take in what harm you may have caused to someone else and say, you know what, you're right, that was wrong, and I'm sorry. It makes it easier for me to fall asleep at night.
Good. I'm glad that you have that. I wish everyone would be able to do that. I mean, I guess the way I try to think of it, because I have been lucky enough to be involved with as a teacher and in my education nonprofit and as a mom, I always feel like, look, young people, kids have not built this world. We've built this world and left them with all of it. And young people, I know we always look at these like videos of babies and we're like, oh, they're so precious. But, you know, please treat our young people that way. All of them, not just babies. I mean, I know babies are hella cute. I love babies, but treat all of our young people as precious. Like, let us all act in a way where we can endeavor to deserve these young people in our lives. And when I was saying earlier about how I think there is this ethics to being writer for children, that's part of it.
I agree. I completely agree. But thank you so much, Shamira. This has been just amazing. I could literally just sit here and listen to you and just engage further with you. This is just, I cannot wait to post this episode. It's just, I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate you just letting me go on and on. Talking is one of my favorite things.
Samesies. Samesies. So for people who are going to obviously get Hollow Fires, if not the rest of your catalog, because you got a lot of stuff coming, like we established, you're busy in a good way too. How may people find out more about your work? See the three P's, the pastries, the politics, and the prose. Like, how do people connect with you?
So people can find me on my website, which is just samiraahmed.com, or you can hear my ramblings on Twitter and my bad photos on Instagram. Both have the same handle, which is @sam_i_m. And that's spelled sam_aye_ahm.
Great. Thank you. And again, y'all, Hollow Fires, May 10th, 2022. But again, by the time this episode airs, it will be out now. So please make sure to delve into that and just hit up the back catalog. And then, like, whatever's coming that Samira may not be able to talk about, just be ready. Be ready. Because I know it's coming. Thank you again, Samira. I hope we get to see each other very soon.
I know. Thanks, Jen.
I mean, pastries.
Oh, yes, please. Everyone, I'm always up for pastries. You know the way to my heart now.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much my go-to as well. Be like, I assume everyone likes cookies. Let's just go with that.
Pastries really got me through this pandemic, man.
My pants are tight. My pants are tight. So again, Samira, you've been the best. I just feel refueled after this discussion. Thank you. Utmost gratitude.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
And thank you all for listening. Once again, this is Minorities in Publishing, which you can find on Tumblr and Twitter and wherever podcasts are. Thanks again. Take care, everybody.